Yeah, I mean, you have to really understand your client, right? And you have to read between the lines, because when you work with a client, you have to understand what they need and what they want. But then you also have to keep in mind that you're the one who has the creative capacity, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if one person, like if your client says, I want it exactly like that, that usually doesn't work, because as a designer, you have hopefully you have expertise to know the best form of color and the composition and stuff like that. So it's basically, you have to create rapport,
mm-hmm.
understand what your client needs, and then ensure him or her that you have the experience and the knowledge to deliver what is best for the client. And that requires a lot of trust, right? Because you have to tell the person, you know, like, let me do something. You may not like it, right? But this is something I think will fit that job or that commission.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. As some of you might know, on August 7th, my new book, An Audience of One, Reclaiming Creativity for Its Own Sake, hits bookshelves. And over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from unmistakable creative guests who appear in the book and from other experts in their field who had a big impact on my ideas in this book. It's filled with some of the most actionable insights from former podcast guests and my own experience to help you develop a lifelong creative practice. If you found the podcast beneficial at all, one of the biggest things that you could do to support us is to pre-order the book. And you can learn more about the special pre-order bonuses that we put together at unmistakablecreative.com/audience. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/audience. Mars, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me again. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it is my pleasure to have you back here. You have been a longtime friend and instrumental collaborator in the creation of the Unmistakable Creative brand. You were a big hit when we had you last time. And I wanted to bring you back this time specifically to talk about collaboration, which is a big part of my new book, An Audience of One, Reclaiming Creativity for Its Own Sake. And I thought you were the perfect example of somebody that I've collaborated with that has expanded my own creative capacity through collaboration. But before we get into all of that, I want to start by asking you, what did your parents do for a living, and what impact did that end up having on the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
So both of my parents have a creative background. My father has a background in graphic design, and my mother studied like fine arts at university in Germany. And that meant that I was being raised in a very creative household. And I remember like when I was in my teens, when my mother said, you know, you're such a creative person, like, promise me not to get like a normal job at a corporation, do something creative.
Mm-hmm.
And that was for me, like, you know, it was normal for me. But when I talked to my classmates, it was like I was talking about unicorns on Mars or something.
Right.
Because to them, right, it's like study some, do something safe, or work at a company or work for the government. Do something that makes sense, that gives you like a real job, so to speak. Right.
Yeah.
And with me, I've never had that experience. I just always heard that argument from friends.
Yeah, no doubt. And what about your dad?
Yeah, so my dad comes more from a graphic design, like drawing corner, and he was basically doing like also freelance art. He did airbrush later on, like back in the late 80s or early 90s. And then he became like a graphic design teacher, like at a private college here in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still having like clients, and nowadays he's also doing like drawing sessions with elderly people, ergotherapy, that's how you call it here. And yeah, so both are really like soaked up by their creativity.
Mm. Do you have siblings?
I don't, unfortunately.
Somehow I suspected that, but I know it's never come up in any of our conversations before. One of the things that really is interesting to me is that you have these parents who have encouraged this. Didn't they ever worry that there would be sort of the uncertainty or the struggle that typically is what you know, concerns most parents about pursuing a career in the arts or pursuing a career that is driven by creativity. Like, did that ever come up?
It did. With my father, who's more like a security kind of guy, that's why he looked for a job where he could lecture it, right? Like a safe job in air quotes. But because I was later on mostly raised by my mother, she was more the optimistic go-getter. So she said, like, listen, if you choose to be a creative, it's going to be much harder. But if you're really, like, if it's really something part of you, and if you really must do it, then you will find a way. And she always had that, like, that fighting spirit, like an Amazon, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Last time we spoke, one, culturally, like, what impact did growing up in Germany end up having on your own work and your own creativity?
So, you know, like, a big difference between Germany and the U.S. is that there's a lot of less risk-taking here in Germany. Germany is more like a secure country where people want to have, like, a safe job. We have far fewer entrepreneurs percentage-wise. I've just read that actually a few days ago that the United States has about 3 or 4 times as many entrepreneurs percentage-wise as Germany. And so it's actually more something that is seen as suspicious or like, are you sure you want to do that? Like, especially in school, right? Are you sure? Like, don't you want to do something more safe? So there's always kind of like an atmosphere of fear.
Yeah, I know that. You know, there was something in Michael Moore did this documentary called Where to Invade Next. And one of the places that he went to was Germany. And he said that often in Germany, he said, despite the atrocities that Germany has in its history, they have made a commitment not to repeat those things. And people are often taught about the Holocaust in schools and the awful things that happened. You know, I've never gotten to talk to you about this. So I wonder, can you tell me a little bit about, you know, how that has shaped your own perception of your own country, like having this as part of the history?
Yes, the thing is that when I went to the States, right, you have U.S. history during high school. In Germany, you just have like global history. And a big part of that is spent on German history. And Germany is still guilty. Like, you still feel the guilt about what happened. And there's so many German movies about Hitler, his architect even, who created like the kind of like neo-romantic, like Berlin, like of all the side characters, like you know so much about those people and about the Holocaust. We have a very famous Jewish museum actually nearby where I live, so you had to go there as well. And yeah, what happens is that when you grow up in a country like Germany, you don't have any sense of national pride.
Mm.
So if you like, there's no patriotic sense, because if you are openly a patriotic, right, people immediately, even Germans will call you like a Nazi, some people, right?
Yeah.
So it's being frowned upon. So you're always very critical of your own history, and you're very careful if you make any sort of compliments, especially concerning the past. Not when your soccer team is doing right. Well at the World Cup, right?
Yeah.
And it's all, yeah, we're the best. But when you say, like, you know, I'm proud to be a German, I mean, that's still very difficult. Some people would say, oh, that's no problem. Other people would say, ah, you should be careful saying that, right? So you're much more critical of your own past. You don't have any national pride, per se. And, yeah, you're just more reflective about that. And it's still an issue that follows you, not every day, but it follows you.
Yeah. Why do you think that that's not more common throughout the world? Because, you know, I think that Germany in particular, obviously, because of the fact that it's so well documented, it was done on such a massive scale, we're well aware of their atrocities. But I don't think that, you know, there are countries that aren't guilty of equally horrible things. Why do you think that that is not more common?
Yeah, well, if you compare it to countries like Russia back then, the Soviet Union, or China, where equally like millions of people have been killed, right?
Mm.
Like in Russia, way more than even than in Germany with the communist regime, and similar in China. And I think it's because those countries are more authoritarian in their approach. And Germany has become so reflective, and we used to be called, like, in the very early days, like hundreds of years ago, the country of the thinkers and the poets. So, like, it's one of the countries where we read the most along in the world, right? I think that the second most used language on Wikipedia is German, and not like Mandarin or Spanish even. It's really German because we have so many entries and it's such a well-read country. I think we're more critical of that because we still are a very, I would say, a progressive democracy, and that ideology, you tend to be more critical of your own history, while other countries tend to be more nationalistic maybe about it.
Yeah, definitely. So as a creative person who creates media, who is an artist, and you know, just in general, what is the impact of having this history and also where you guys are at in the world stage in terms of how creativity gets expressed and how media gets created and how stories are told in Germany? Because I think that one of the things that's becoming very apparent to me is that our reality is largely shaped by the media we're consuming.
Yes. Yeah, well, the funny thing is, in Germany, actually, when I grew up, I read mostly comic books. And Germany, I would say, I have to say, unfortunately, that our creative industry is quite dismal compared to even like other European countries like France. Like when I was a kid, I mostly read French comics, which are very popular in Germany. Then I think I transitioned to American comics and later on Japanese comics, what they call manga. Mm. And all of them influenced my creativity. But with Germany, we don't have good creativity. Like, considering that we're the fourth biggest economy in the world, that we have low unemployment, we're great at technology, science, engineering, all that jazz, but yeah, we really lack in the creative department. And so you had to basically get consumed by your neighbors, by America, by Japan, right? Like you had to get it from anywhere else besides Germany.
Yeah. Well, I remember flying a Lufthansa flight I think my flight stopped in Frankfurt, and I remember feeling, I was like, wow, this airline is a bastion of efficiency. Like this is clearly what they're good at. You know, like everybody boarded on time. We got off on time. It was the most orderly thing I'd ever experienced on an airline flight.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cliche, but it may not be true for every state that we have, but in general, that tends to be the approach of that we're good at engineering because of all the famous car companies, like the chemistry, like the pharmaceutical and all those industries. But unfortunately, like in a creative field, yeah, you always lack that. But thanks to the internet, I mean, it was all replaced by creativity from all around the planet.
Yeah, definitely. So last time we spoke, you told me about this moment when you were in a grocery store with your mother and found these comic books next to the ice cream. Can you take us back to that moment? And let's relive that, because it was one of my favorite stories I ever heard on the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I was around 6 or 7 years old, and my mother and I, and I think my cousin went to like the EC, which is like, we do have an ocean, by the way, right in the north. It's pathetic, right, compared to the US, but we still have it. It's tiny.
Yeah.
And we went to like a beach town. And, you know, I used to be addicted to ice cream. I was like hooked on it. Like every time I saw ice cream, I just wanted to eat it like really like a monster, just gulp it up. So we went to the supermarket, I went to the ice cream area, and next to it was basically a magazine stand. And I was 6 or 7 years old. I saw those very colorful like magazines and comic books, and I just like walked to it like being spellbound. I picked up like the issue, the first issue of Ghostbusters, you know, the comic book. Mm-hmm. And then I was so basically captured by the drawings. I couldn't read back then, but it's just the design, the colors, everything. I was so spellbound by it that I begged my mother to get it. But she said, you know what? Like, you wanted to ice cream. Like, you have to decide. Do you want the comic book or do you want the ice cream? And it's almost like in a Hollywood movie where my head switches back and forth, right? Ice cream, comic book, ice cream, comic book. And I went for the comic book because it was just – it just impacted me more, and that was basically the start where I started drawing and became a fan of pictures and motion stories and stuff like that.
Yeah. What did your mom do after that to encourage this interest?
Well, I have to say, like in that time, I was more inspired by my father because my mother was always into like fine painting, like using brushes, being a little bit more abstract. And my father was always sketching and drawing very figuratively at home. And I was just seeing that, and I was just repeating that, right? I just saw what he was doing. I thought like, huh, that looks like fun. And because I was starting to read comics back then, I started drawing comics, copying him basically. And because my mother was also super creative, she said, like, go for it, just go for it.
Mm. Did you ever have any formal training, or was it almost all learned through the fact that, you know, your parents were there and you were just exposed to all this material?
Yeah, it was just like basically copying. I had a few mentors back in my high school time, like comic artists in Germany that I emailed to. But yeah, it's just learning by doing and just doing excessively.
Yeah. When you were a kid, what did you envision that this would lead to? Did you imagine that you would be like an illustrator at a comic, or you know, creating superheroes? What was your vision of what this would look like when you were six, and how has that changed with time?
Yeah, well, I mean, in that age, I didn't think about my career or jobs at all.
Yeah.
So when I was maybe like 12 or around 13, I thought like, this is so much fun. Like, I should do this for a living. And back then, my plan was to be a comic artist, a comic book artist.
Mm-hmm.
And that has changed a little bit over time, obviously, you know, like, because I thought like at some stage I didn't like drawing stories anymore. I just liked the aspect of drawing and designing. So it went from like illustration design, maybe game design or like magazine design. It just, but it always moved around that visual design area, right?
Yeah, no doubt. So one of the things I think that obviously has made me one of the biggest fans of your work is the fact that you really, truly are in so many ways the epitome of the term unmistakable. In fact, I think we can actually trace the notion of unmistakable creative and that concept of unmistakable back to one of the very first conversations I had with you, because you said it yourself. You said that when you see my work, I don't want to have to put my name on it. You'll immediately know it's mine, which is so true. I mean, that characterizes your work perfectly, because I recognize it every single time that I see it, even when it's not something you've done for us. And somehow you've also mastered the ability to take something that you've done for us and make it uniquely ours. So a couple of different things. So I know that from our previous conversations that you traveled all over the world. You mentioned French comics, you've mentioned manga, you mentioned American comics. What have you pulled from each culture that has influenced the way that you draw today? And your art today?
Yeah, so for example, when it comes to like European comics, they have a very, like, they don't draw superheroes, for example, right? I mean, they do exist, but they're very rare. Usually it's around more mature stories, all genres, and they have very characteristic looking people that don't have a lot of muscles, like they're no athletes, right? So you have a lot of unique characters that kind of look like real people, but they're more extreme, right? With big noses or other extremely placed features. And that's something that also like inspired my drawing style, that I was looking more towards like people that I could take from real life, just make it more extremely looking, right? Just you put more emphasis on certain body parts. And I was, for example, never drawing like athletes, like in the American version where superheroes are just, they're basically all bodybuilders on steroids, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was never interested in that. So that's where the European influence comes from. When it comes to like Japan, Japan is very unique, obviously. And they have, especially when it comes to like the faces and everything, looks very stereotypically. Like there's not a lot of features like in the European comics.
Yeah.
But they do, they have an impressive way of telling a story. They use way more images than we do in the West.
Mm-hmm.
That's why their books tend to be like paperbacks, right? Like an average comic in the US is like 25, 20 or 30 pages. In manga, it's usually like 80 or 150 pages, because they take so much more time telling a story. And they have a very, not all of them, obviously, but they tend to have more wicked fashion. Like the way they draw clothes, it's so much more unique than what we do in the West. And I took basically that inspiration and infused it into my own drawing style.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, French comics make sense to me. How did you end up reading Japanese comics? Because they're in Japanese. Did you learn Japanese?
Well, I did, but much later on. Back then, it was just that in my local comic shop, we were starting to get, like, you know, back then it was just ruled by American and European comics, mostly from France.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, like within years, you saw like those small manga, and they were basically, they looked like trade paperbacks, but with obviously that Japanese drawing style, and they were completely different from what I've added, from what I had seen before. Right, they were black and white. They had a very unique writing drawing style, and it just they imported a few of them, and then they became more popular, and then it became a real cult and a trend. And then you actually saw like girls coming to comic book stores, which had never happened before.
Wow. So I want to talk briefly about your actual creative practice and your habits, and then we'll get into why I really wanted to have you here. You know, you alluded to it last time, but what does this look like every day? I mean, I remember you saying that you draw for 3 hours a day. So I'm wondering, what does that look like? What is your habit? Like, what does your creative practice look like?
Yeah, so I usually draw before. I also write a lot nowadays in English. But when I draw, I have a certain amount of time that I want to spend on writing and drawing. I usually start with writing because I need more brain energy to do that. And when I draw, I can basically do it on a back burner with the music blasting from my speakers. And yeah, I mean, I always learn something about drawing every single day. So there are tons of tutorials on YouTube and other platforms. I always want to make sure that I learn something new each and every day. It can be one thing only, but it has to be something each and every day. So I make progress. And then I do a little bit of sketching, right? I do everything digitally. I have like a graphic tablet. It's hooked to my iMac. And I basically just start sketching in black and white to just create like a flow moment and to really get my hands used to drawing, right? Like when I type before that, it's a different process than drawing. So I want to make sure there's a transition. So I do that for like 5 or 10 minutes, and then I start doing client work or do something for myself, like in private. And yeah, then I listen to Japanese pop music because it's wicked. I don't understand the lyrics anymore. But it gets me into a good mood. It has a good beat, and it allows me to basically flow with my artwork.
Hey, it's Srini. I know that I've told many of you in the last few episodes about our upcoming live taping of the Unmistakable Creative podcast in New York City, where I'll be interviewing former Unmistakable Creative guest Sarah Peck on Thursday, August 9th. And I just wanted to let you know that as part of your ticket to the live event, you'll actually get a copy of my new book, An Audience of One, Reclaiming Creativity for Its Own Sake. So if you want to learn more about the live taping, visit unmistakablecreative.com/live, and I look forward to meeting you in person. You know, what struck me most was that you said that you're always looking to improve. Do you know what kinds of improvements that you're looking for before you try to make those improvements? And when you're seeking out, you know, things to learn, what do you go and look for?
Yeah, so there are basically two things in general when it comes to drawing. One thing is that I'm looking for is improve the craft, right? That means learning more about anatomy, learning more about composition, white space, like structure and stuff like that, which is basically the skill of drawing. And the other focus is more on the technical side, is where, because I draw mostly digitally, is that I learned something about Photoshop, new tricks, something about layers, about colors that I can use in a better way. Maybe learning about a new program or a new plugin that I could use, or a better way to basically save my files with high quality, but in a tiny size, so it's more, it's easier to see on the web and it doesn't take as many resources, right?
Yeah, definitely. Wow. All right. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears and let's start talking about why I really wanted to talk to you, which is because of the fact that you have been an instrumental creative collaborator. But I think to really get there, we have to talk about how this all started. So talk to me about like what made you see an opportunity to collaborate with me? And I'll kind of, you know, explain my thought process behind why I started to understand the power that we had doing this together.
I have to think back of, I mean, I remember that you were approaching me because I was popping up in the blogosphere all over the place. According to you, you made me like really good compliments, very specific ones too. And then you interviewed me, and then I started following you on Twitter, and we had a few tweets back and forth. And I don't even know what the first project was. Was it like a cover that I designed?
It was a book cover. It was a book cover for the Small Army Strategy. And I remember you read the book and you came back to me and you said, Srini, this book would be much better if it had a good cover.
Exactly. Like, I love that book. I thought that for some reason, you know, like I could really add something to it. And I thought, you know what, like, I have the perfect picture in mind that really represents what your book is about. Mm-hmm. And I think it wasn't even like a commission, right? I think I just drew it for you because it was like a creative urge.
Yeah.
And then I showed it to you and I thought, like you said, like, man, that's really, really good, right? And it was like love at first sight.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. I mean, so much so that you kind of became my go-to for almost anything graphic design related, specifically when it came to things like book covers. I think the thing that really struck me, and you know, I remember I came back to you after that to do The Art of Being Unmistakable. And what I wonder, how do you take the content of something and decide to depict it visually? Like, what informs that process? Like, how do you decide that, okay, this is like, even when you did the cover for Art of Being Unmistakable, it was kind of like, wow, that is pretty amazing.
Yeah. So when it comes to book covers, for example, you have to keep a few things in mind. One of them is obviously that you want to know something about the target audience. So if it were a science fiction book, I would design it in a way different way than obviously like a nonfiction book. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing, that you keep your genre or your nonfiction target audience in mind. And the other thing is that it should reflect what the content is about. And when you have a book about being unmistakable, then you cannot have a generic cover. I mean, it's almost like a hypocrisy, right? Imagine like writing that book and then you have like a really boring ass cover that is so like generic and bland that people say like, how's that like... How can that work, right? You write about unmistakable and that is complete opposite of what you're preaching. Mm. So I had to make sure that person, right, that has a very unique fashion style, that is very energetic, and then that the cover itself speaks exactly what the book is about, so that it's congruent with the message.
Yeah.
And it didn't take long for me to create the sketch, right? Obviously, like the details and the colors, that took a while.
Right.
But to have that idea of that figure and that almost heroic, energetic pose, that was basically like coming like a like a thunder to my mind.
Yeah, no doubt. I think the thing, like I said, that really the process of working with you and other artists made me aware of is the fact that it stretched my creative capacity. Suddenly the things that I thought I didn't have the skill to do, I could accomplish by working with other people who had those skills and complemented what I was trying to do. Like, you could bring my vision to life. Let's talk about kind of this process of how you and I work together, because I think that this is really, in my mind, probably the best example of how creative collaboration has helped me stretch my capacity. I mean, I think book cover was an example, but I think we've had a lot of other projects where my feedback, I think, was a lot more detailed. I mean, even, you know, I think the process of rebranding the podcast as Unmistakable Creative, you were instrumental to that process. So talk to me, let's talk kind of about the back and forth that you and I go through. I know that I've probably made you insane at certain points, but I'm curious, like, when you come to me, what do you look for in order to ensure that I will be happy with the end result?
Yeah, I mean, you have to really understand your client, right? And you have to read between the lines, because when you work with a client, you have to understand what they need and what they want. But then you also have to keep in mind that you're the one who has the creative capacity, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if one person, like if your client says, I want it exactly like that, that usually doesn't work, because as a designer, you have hopefully you have expertise to know the best form of color and the composition and stuff like that. So it's basically, you have to create rapport.
Mm-hmm.
Understand what your client needs, and then ensure him or her that you have the experience and the knowledge to deliver what is best for the client. And that requires a lot of trust, right? Because you have to tell the person, you know, like, let me do something. You may not like it, right? But this is something I think will fit that job or that commission, right? Mm-hmm. And then you do your sketching, right? That's, I think, the most helpful thing. Instead of just talking about it, you create sketches of the ideas you create, agreed upon. And we did a lot of sketches, right? Like concerning like the logo or maybe even like a web banner or even like additional covers later on. Mm-hmm. Like you always create sketches that are never very detailed, but they are very basic in the color, but they give you a basic idea. And you take it from there, right?
Yeah. I think the other thing that you have always done, and I think this is largely something I learned from a handful of projects, is that you always put options in front of me, but you never go too far in any one direction until I say, okay, like, you know, your sketches tend to be far less detailed. And I'm like, okay, I like this. I don't like this. Choose this, you know. And I think that in my mind, that's been really kind of one of those instrumental things. How do other people, in your mind, I think in a lot of ways, the fact that I figured out collaborating with you would stretch my creative capacity was a really fortunate accident. I don't think I truly understood that until it just occurred to me one day. I said, oh, you know, you remember, I emailed you and I said, hey, we're redesigning the website. I want you to design all the icons because we can't use stock photography for this stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that the fact that it took so long for that to occur to me is really strange. How do other people recognize where they have potential weaknesses and where they might be able to leverage a collaborator to expand what they're trying to do?
You mean where the client has weakness?
Yeah. How does somebody come to the realization that I did that, hey, wait a minute, this is something that I want to bring to life, and rather than me trying to do it myself, I should find somebody like Mars to do it with.
Yeah, I mean, it always starts with an open mind and a desire to collaborate and to have basically to take a risk. I mean, it's always connected to risk, right? The other person is not going to be a robot that does everything you wanted to do. Mm-hmm. You have to trust that you're hiring. The reason why you hire someone is because you usually don't have the time or the talent to do it yourself, right?
Yeah.
So it's a back and forth. And you should have, basically, it comes down to being open-minded, having the desire to collaborate, and to really pick the right person that you think is a good fit for you that really compensates for what you lack.
Yeah, for sure. You've brought up trust and being open-minded multiple times throughout this conversation, which I think is such an interesting part of collaboration. And I think that one of the things that trips people up is they have a very stubborn vision of what they want something to look like. And when it doesn't meet that expectation, they feel that the collaboration is a disaster and you know, all sorts of bad stuff happens. But I mean, you and I haven't exactly, it hasn't always been smooth sailing. I think the movie posters were a perfect example of over and over and over and over. How did you keep from, you know, losing your mind and not wanting to work with me again?
Well, I think at that stage, I had worked with you multiple times before, so that helped. We had Skype before, so we actually had built already a tight relationship. And I have to say, with that example, I think it has also to do with cultural understanding, because I'm from Germany and you're from the US, right? And there are some cultural differences. And in Germany, for example, people always tell you straight away what they want, and they tell you what's wrong. And in the US, it tends to be more less direct. And it's more like you have to read between the lines.
Yeah, no doubt.
And then you have to think, because I was, you know, for the posters, a lot of them were women, right?
Yeah.
And it was just, that was my German style where I thought, you know, just like, be inspired by the photographs and then draw the way they are. And if they have like crow's feet around their ears, right?
Right.
Then you include it, and you were basically saying, no, you can't do that. Like, that's going to like, I can't have them, right? So I was a bit more pleasant, and I did a little bit of youth extension concerning the characters, and that was something I realized later on.
Well, it was really, I think, one of my favorite projects to work with you on, even though at moments it was a pain in the ass, because to me there were moments that were hilarious. It was like, you have to make this person look younger. I'm like, there are way too many curves on this person, you know, stuff like that. But I think the thing that really struck me about that project was how this collaborative process is very iterative. How, you know, you keep going through, you know, one round after another until you get get to a point where you're finally like, all right, this is, I mean, I like to this day, I am blown away by how amazing that turned out. And I remember when people walked into the room, particularly the speakers, and they saw those for the first time, they were like, wow, this is by far one of the coolest takeaways you'll ever get from a conference.
Yeah. And I want to add something to that. I think the thing why it was a little bit complicated, right, and why we had a lot of back and forth was because before that, everything I did was for you and your brand, right?
Right, right.
And in that case, it was, of course, for you and your brand, but it was also appealing to the speakers who were being represented.
Yeah.
So I was only thinking about pleasing you and thought like, I know he likes this one, right? Right. He will like this style.
Yeah.
If I do it like that, he will like it.
Yeah.
And I had the people that I was portraying not in mind. So I was not thinking about pleasing them in right. any shape or form.
Yeah, for sure. You know, the other fun fact about this is that you and I have actually never met each other in person.
Yes. It's
after,
crazy.
What, 5 years of working together?
No, longer, man. I think longer. It's 7 or 8 years by now.
So if we've never met each other in person for 7 or 8 years, what do you think that has allowed us to sustain such a powerful collaboration that, you know, like has gone so well?
Well, first of all, I still think you're like an alien AI that is communicating with me. No, so jokes aside, it comes down to, I think the relationship we've built, we can only build over time.
Yeah.
So there's no way you can have that kind of depth with your first commission, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's something like, if you build something for the first time with another client, your first commission, right, you can really quickly see if you can build rapport or if you can build something that goes beyond just having a standard client agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And because you really dug my style and I really like what your brand was doing, the inspirational aspect of it, like the backstory behind it, you know, as soon as we had like a second or third project, I was understanding you much better. I was learning more about your brand. And the more you learn about someone, the more you understand what their desires are and what they want to express with their brand. I mean, you can't help but being more emotionally attached to it. And then obviously after a while, it turns like into like a friendship basically. And it comes down to interest, curiosity, finding common threats, mm-hmm. and taking it from there.
Yeah. I think that, you know, you brought up interest, curiosity, and common threads. You know, as I was writing Audience of One, you know, I dedicated an entire section to this concept of collaboration. And I looked at the common threads between the collaborators that I had very successful collaborations with. And I think the thing that really, probably the things that stood out to me were that there's no ego or envy from either side for each mm-hmm. other's success or lack thereof in cases. You always basically put the partnership over each other's individual gain. Mm-hmm. No ego at all, which we kind of talked about. And also confidence in one another, I think, was another really big one for me because, you know, anytime I've done something with you, I feel confident that you'll deliver. Like we may not start out with what we want, but I know that the end result will always end up being what I want it to be.
Yeah. And, because you knew what you wanted and I knew that, I knew what you liked about my style. Right. So it's really about building the trust and yeah. And after trust, right. Obviously you build the confidence because you know each other quite well in terms of the work. And like you said, like, you know, if I only like, if I had focused on my ego and just pleasing myself, I think we could have never built that relationship because, you know, my goal was basically to make sure that my artwork really helps you and your brand, that you have a direct benefit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if I only think about pushing certain styles or thinking like, this should be it because that's my trademark and that's what I would like to see, then, I mean, it's just a blatant disregard for your client.
Mm.
So it really matters how you spend your focus, right? If it's just on you and presenting yourself, I don't think you can build any good relationship with a client, right? But if you really focus on giving value to that person and focusing on them and improving their brand and their life, then I think there's much better collaboration happening.
Yeah. How much of your work do we not see? How much of it is done in private that you keep for yourself and you do just for the sake of your own joy?
Well, with you specifically, I show you a lot of my work.
Sure.
Because like all, you know, like the alternative, the sketches,
yeah,
the version A, B, C, D, what have you. But with other clients, I do some sketching that they will never see because it's quite, to put it in air quotes, dirty, right? It's not very specific. It's just for me to help me think about what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, a lot of it is also thinking, which looks like daydreaming, but it's actually me like really thinking about what I'm going to do, like what is best for the client. And that is also part of the work because I cannot just like start right away the very second after I have like the instruction, right? I'm not a robot. Like you have to ruminate, you have to consider multiple angles. And if you have thought it all out, then you start with the first sketch and you think like, how can I show a better alternative? How can I show something from a different angle? And then you just build it step by step, like a Lego pyramid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the other question, I guess, is how much of this, other than, you know, sketching for clients that you don't show, is there work that you do just for your own joy, that you want to create, you want to see exist in the world, and it's just for your own enjoyment?
That's a good question. I do have a sketchbook and I do occasionally sketch in it, and I haven't shown much of it to the world. Mostly it's about figures, certain concepts. I love science fiction and technology, so I draw like new inventions that I could use in my story or maybe in my artwork. But I have to say lately in the past years, most of what I do is actually like always with the intention to please a client or to just put it out there in the world and maybe gather interest.
Mm.
So because, you know, my father is very reclusive with his work. Like he's just, most of the stuff he creates, he never shows to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought that was a waste of talent. Like as a creative, if you create such amazing work,
yeah,
you almost have like a responsibility to show it. So I tend to actually show most of my work nowadays.
It's interesting. It's funny because it kind of goes counter to some of the argument that I'm making in this upcoming book. But I think that the thing that I've said, one of the things that really hit home for me when I wrote this, I said, you know, often in doing our work in private, we actually we plant the seeds for some of our most resonant work that ends up being shared with the public.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there is, I'm not surprised that that's the case. I think there's probably a great deal of value in the things that we don't see because they probably inform the things that we do see.
Yeah. And the more you do, I mean, I don't think as much as I used to, and I don't mean that like in a bad way. I think it comes down to experience as well. If you have a curiosity and an open mind and you soak everything up in your environment and what you read and what you watch and what you learn from people, and when you produce a lot, and that's so important, to produce a lot of work. You know, at some point, you're just into like a zone where you can draw basically from any corner.
Mm. Wow. Wow. Well, this has been truly awesome. I am really, really glad that we got to have you come back to The Unmistakable Creative for a second time. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything that you're up to?
Yeah, so my home base is still MarsDorian.com. It's Mars like the red planet and Dorian like the picture of Dorian Gray. And Mars Dorian is basically my handle that I use for my entire presence. So if you want to follow me on Twitter, do it at MarsDorian.com. Instagram as well, at MarsDorian. It's a bit more visual. You see all of my drawings, books, covers, and stuff like that. And yeah, that's where I usually hang out on the interwebs.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.